Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Decrypt. My name is Nick Rice, and I'll be your host today, where we're going to be talking about the situation in Ukraine 2 years on since the Russian invasion of the country. And I'm delighted to have with me Botta Ilias. Botta is an analyst in our European Global Risk Analysis team. She specializes in covering the conflict in Ukraine and specifically the neighboring region as well. Botta, it's a pleasure to have you on Decrypt.
Great to be here. Hi, Nick.
Hi. And Stina is a frequent flyer on the podcast that everybody will remember. Stina joins us from Copenhagen. She is running our strategic cyber threat intelligence capabilities at Control Risks. Stina, it's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Nick. Really good to be back.
Great. Well, guys, as I said, we've been talking about Ukraine for a little while. Our Control Risks certainly, and there's a series of different components that will be coming out or that have recently come out showcasing our analysis, but really sort of the advisory that we're starting to provide to organizations who are thinking about potentially what happens next. But I want to take a little step back. Stina, you remember a year ago, we were talking in this room about a year on from the invasion, a year on from the beginning of the conflict, what we were seeing from a cyber perspective. And I think the situation on the ground sort of changed quite significantly since then. And it would be great, Botta, to get your initial take on what you see as some of the key defining characteristics of the situation today.
Yeah, certainly. So I think you have already touched on something really important, which is that the situation used to be quite different. A year ago, things have not been going as great when it comes to Ukraine's military successes on the battlefields. Mm-hmm. So Russia in the past few months has gained a slight advantage on the front lines. Ukraine's counteroffensive has been quite slow and gradual. So they haven't been able to make as much territorial advances as they were hoping to for various military reasons. One of them being that US military aid has dried up in the past few months. And this is quite important because US is by far Ukraine's largest military backer and economic one as well. So yeah, the situation on the front lines has been quite different, but the war continues. And I think it's something that's really important to keep in mind is that even though Russia over the past few months has made some tactical gains in the east, this does not mean that Russia is winning the war. A few tactical advances here and there do not mean a strategic victory for Russia. And this is something I'm happy to expand on a little later on. But I think something worth keeping in mind is that the West, the majority of Western countries and NATO specifically, continue to view this not just as a war between two countries, but as a far bigger threat to regional and even global security, really, as they are keen to contain a more belligerent Russia, but also very importantly, to show Russia and potentially other state actors in global affairs that it is not okay to invade a neighboring country for no reason. It was a very unprovoked full-scale invasion. So yeah, the lesson here that they're trying to show is that you cannot just in 2022 or 2024 or in the future just invade a neighboring country and try to withdraw globally accepted state boundaries.
It's interesting you say this, Botta, because I think, Stina, we talked about this a year ago, but the NATO angle was one in cyber that was quite momentous from the perspective of what had historically been discussed as where the red lines would exist from a cyber perspective. When would a cyber attack constitute essentially a trigger for military escalation? And a year ago, we talked about, or I think even 2 years ago, it was very, very shortly after the beginning of the conflict, where we had the Secretary General of NATO sort of coming out saying, look, a cyber attack on a NATO member state could be considered as reason to trigger the mutual defense clause of the alliance. How has the situation from a cyber perspective evolved, Stina? If we look back at the beginning of the war and where we are today, have we seen significant changes?
Thanks, Nick. And I think it's a really good reminder as well of the stages we've gone through on our end in terms of viewing this conflict and where it's gone since 2022. I mean, I think it's fair to say that we haven't defined the red line here yet, given what we've seen on the ground in terms of cyber activity, the high tempo of actions by Russia-aligned groups within the kind of setting of the conflict, and certainly within the space of both disruptive and destructive attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure that has been part of this conflict. I think in terms of what we're seeing at the moment for the past couple of months, so as we've said kind of and seen from the start, what we see in the cyber domain reflects very much what is happening on the ground and the evolution in kind of how the conflict is playing out. So certainly a big proportion of what we're seeing now is intelligence gathering for operational purposes to understand what is happening in the conflict, but also at a strategic level, you know, things like, you know, war crimes investigations, things like understanding, you know, supply lines and so forth. So that's right. A big component of this. And of course, the one that we haven't seen gone away really from the start is in the disruptive and destructive attack space, where we still see Russia very much still leveraging Ukraine as a testing ground, as is something we've discussed now, not just since 2022, but for the last 10 years, this is where Russia uses its most impactful cyber weaponry. And that still remains the case today.
It's interesting you say that, Stina, because I think, Balta, that echoes the point that you were making around the symbolism behind the current situation, where from a Western perspective and from NATO's perspective, this is about drawing the boundaries of what can be accepted in the conception of international order and global affairs by these countries. But vice versa, from a Russian perspective, this is equally existential for the current regime and sort of the success of the war. Are you seeing, when you look at the way the war is portrayed on the other side of it, a similar sort of push towards this is so critical and we will put every resources available behind it?
Yes, absolutely. And this is actually one of the key reasons why we believe that the war is unlikely to end anytime soon.
Right.
I do think it's likely to continue at least into 2025. And this is an excellent question, really. I think it's important to understand the drivers behind Russia's decision-making as well. And Russia as the aggressor here, I think it is up to Russia essentially to end the war,
right?
Because we're talking about Ukraine's sovereign borders, we're talking about Ukraine's sovereign territory, and Ukraine rightfully refuses to give up any of its territory,
right,
essentially, right? And one of the fundamental reasons why the war is unlikely to end is that for Putin, his success and successes of the Russian army in Ukraine, he views them as critical to his own political legitimacy domestically, right? It's been 2 years, he's just too far into it. I think at a minimum, he is keen to fully cement Russia's control of the occupied territory in Ukraine's east and the south. And domestically, absolutely, you're right. You were quite spot on, right? Russian propaganda is quite strong. It's very prolific. And Putin has used the past 2 years since the start of the full-scale invasion to further eliminate the very few voices, independent media voices, oppositionists that had existed in the very narrow space already. So there are way fewer of those now. And the Kremlin, as of now, does hold a very tight control of the media landscape, the political and the security environment. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. Domestically, it is very much portrayed as something that poses an existential threat to Russia. So not to Putin's survival, but to Russia's survival, right? So the narrative, of course, is that so NATO has been expanding post-Cold War. They had promised us that they wouldn't do that.
Right.
Now look at them. They were going to admit Ukraine into NATO, which, by the way, is not true.
Yeah.
It's actually quite the opposite. Putin was the full-scale invasion. It has actually brought Ukraine so much closer to joining NATO and EU than it would have otherwise been able to do without the invasion. So yeah, this is very much part of the domestic narrative,
right,
which is that had we not invaded Ukraine, NATO would have attacked us.
Yeah.
We were under a threat.
And it's fascinating you say this, and it's not because we have a Swede sitting in Copenhagen on the podcast today, but there is, I believe, two countries that since the invasion began have now joined NATO. The impact and sort of the consequences in redrawing the military alliance and boundaries are very, very clearly there. I do want to bounce back on the word that you use here, Balta, around propaganda, because one of the tactical manifestation of the conflict, and that's projected beyond the Ukrainian border, has been around disinformation campaigns. And Stina, we were talking about this. You know, we've got European Parliament elections coming. We have a US election. And Balta, you mentioned, you know, the US is part of the major sort of deltas in the equations to get the situation on the ground progressing in one way or the other. Stina, can you sort of walk us through a little bit more what we've seen from that disinformation perspective? You know, where do we expect? Has this been equally a laboratory for sort of deepfakes, use of Gen AI, or sort of large scale disinformation campaigns?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, coming back to Botta's point about the prioritization and the importance of this, that information operations side of things is going to be equally critical, both on the domestic front, absolutely, but also in influencing how communities view the conflict. So there's certainly, there's a lot of activity here that is targeting Ukrainian speakers, absolutely, but also targeting supporters of Ukraine. And I think that's where we see a lot of it. Also coming back to your point around kind of who has joined NATO since, there is a knock-on in that, and it sits within the information and influence operations space, but also within the cyberspace, certainly in terms of retaliatory attacks, which is something that we'll continue to see. I think that undercurrent of influence operations and disinformation campaigns is something that has been part of the arsenal, right, in pushing that and pushing Russian objectives before 2022. But the kind of scale of it, as well as the direction of it, you know, there is absolutely the objective to discourage, to kind of degrade support, particularly in countries that start to question and look at this. And I think that's where also Botta's point earlier around the kind of unity around what West is doing and why we're doing it is important as well, because mm-hmm. this is a long game, right? There are, you know, yes. short-term objectives and targets in the suite of Russian targeting, but there's also the long game, right? It is eroding that support, is starting to underpin kind of movements that don't want to see this continue and so forth. So it is a big part of it. And obviously, you know, the usual outlets, the social media platforms, the kind of targeting there. But as you mentioned as well, Nick, the added tool set of Gen AI, of technology that can enable this kind of more convincing disinformation campaigns, more convincing things that come out to these communities to try and influence and sway where they land on this matter.
I want to take us, we will go back to where we see the situation evolving, or where the sort of our future projections of both the on the ground and from a cyber perspective, the risk is likely to evolve. But I want to get a little bit more tactical with both of you. You know, a lot of the concerns that organizations have today in the private sector is they've either had to withdraw operations from Russia or Ukraine, or potentially have had to sort of slow down FDI in either locations. The question that keeps coming back is, you know, what do we need to be thinking about right now? And importantly, what are the tactical implications of the conflict on private sector organizations? You know, a year ago, we talked about the massive impact of the sanctions from the US and the EU on the operationalization of even networks for companies that had operations in Russia or had operations in Ukraine. If you sort of had to kind of give some pointers to organizations and to their security department, what should they be thinking about? And maybe we can open up with you first, Balta. When you think about the current situation on the ground, what are the risks to businesses that are either planning on going back into Ukraine eventually or still have operations there?
So Ukraine has long been a fairly complex jurisdiction to from a foreign business perspective, right? There had always been a host of issues, a legacy of the Soviet Union, right? Mm-hmm. So essentially things pertaining to corruption, rule of law, mm-hmm. judiciary, and at some points political instability, knowing that the country mm-hmm. has had two revolutions, right? So those issues are there, although there has been an improvement in the broader business environment. Right. And that's something also that I learned when I went to Kyiv myself in November of last year. And mm-hmm. I spoke to a bunch of people on the ground, and everyone had told me that the perception of corruption outside of the country, for instance, is actually worse than the perception within the country.
Right.
So that on that side of things, I would say the more traditional barriers to market entry, they are still there. But what the war has done is that it has added a whole set of new challenges yes. when it comes to doing business in the country. So obviously, martial law with mm-hmm. the resulting restrictions such as capital and currency controls,
right?
Also things like the difficulty obtaining insurance. And mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that would apply to cyber risk as well. It's been very difficult to obtain insurance in the country, and multilateral international partners of Ukraine's are currently taking steps to help relaunch the private insurance and reinsurance markets in the country, because that is going to be critical for the country's recovery efforts. But also things like the lack of labor and skilled yes. labor
yeah.
has been a massive issue, given the fact that so many Ukrainians have had to leave the country. And also the country's population is so much smaller relative to Russia's. And as the war continues, sadly, Ukraine, unlike Russia, is going to have to mobilize increasingly mm-hmm. from the working age population, mm-hmm. from the economically active segments of the population. And I'm pretty sure this applies to the cyber and IT talent as well, even though the male population is obviously still unable to leave yeah. the country because of martial law. But I think something really important to keep in mind is that the government is very well aware of the fact that private capital is going to be absolutely crucial yeah. for the country's 100%. Reconstruction yeah. and recovery efforts going forward. So the authorities, they are quite savvy when it comes to understanding the need to balance one, national security interests and the defense interests on the one hand.
Yeah.
So making sure that they have enough to protect the country, to continue fighting. That's on one hand. But on the other hand, but also to increase the country's attractiveness for foreign investment, right? So that's good news, right? And the fact that Ukraine is very keen to join the EU mm-hmm. and is keen to continue accelerating and implementing EU accession reforms, mm-hmm. that is likely to continue yeah. gradually driving improvements in the broader business environment, including, especially when it comes to cyber and digital sphere as well. So we are likely to see a gradual improvement of the yeah. broader business environment in the country, even though the war is continuing, because in fact, the authorities mm. since 2022 have only accelerated the necessary business reforms.
If you have any questions about any topics regarding cybersecurity or technology issues, please feel free to email us and our experts will get back to you. I think those points, and Stina, I want to come back to you on a couple of things that Bota just flagged here, but I think that the rapprochement with the EU, and especially when we consider the European Digital Single Market Act and the plethora of regulations are coming out from an EU perspective in the tech space, that definitely sort of coincides very well with where certainly the future of European cyber and European digital technologies looks forward to. And Ukraine had historically been one of the primary sources of technical talent and on the continent. So certainly an interesting sort of lens of opportunity is to be viewed here. But Stina, from your perspective, when you think about it at a tactical level, you know, for those organizations that are intending to go back into Ukraine, or even those that are operating within the periphery and could potentially be targeted or at risk from operations that relate to the conflict, what's sort of your key takeaways in terms of things our clients are concerned with and that they should be thinking about?
I think there's two broad kind of areas that we're seeing, particularly clients that kind of come and speak to us about this. So one is obviously understanding the direct exposure, right? Whether yeah. you're planning to invest, whether you're planning to enter, re-enter, you have operations, so on, to understand what the landscape looks like in terms of that business decision. And I think for security teams in particular, understanding the knock-on effects, not just potentially inside Ukraine, but also actually at HQ level at other locations. We've seen kind of through working with clients, one of the key trends that we're seeing more is the kind of uptick in targeting of companies that announce that they will invest in Ukraine, that they will enter Ukraine, companies mm-hmm. that pledge support in one way or another, right? So there's quite an immediate, and I think at a tactical level, it's important to be aware of, this is not just a case of looking at it down the line when we're there, when we got boots on the ground, so to speak, in Ukraine. Actually, when that decision comes, and particularly around the kind of announcements, you're likely to see an uptick already then, right? You're likely to see activity, and being prepared for that is going to help you be able to respond to that, because it is, from our experience, going to be some of the more sophisticated actors across the spectrum, right? Both right. In terms of intel collection as well as disruption in the form of ransomware attacks, for example. So that's, I think, the kind of direct angle to that is really mm-hmm. important, and that needs to be factored in throughout the cycle, right? Think about the critical moments. When is things announced? What kind of impact will that have on operations, on assets, but also on people, right? On key executives, on people that kind of have their name on this particular decision right. or aspect of it. The other one, which is, again, something that we're seeing particularly now on the back of as you're discussing here, the kind of thinking around rebuilding, about reconstruction, about reinvestment, is really around the more operational side of things, what both touches on here, and on the digital side, what does that look like, and how do companies actually set up not just secure operations? Security is absolutely front and center of that, but also resilient operations, bearing in mind, you know, the telco, the IT infrastructure is one of the most targeted, both on our end mm-hmm. of the spectrum, but also for kinetic attacks. How do you build something that's resilient? How do you make sure you kind of have that redundancy built into your business planning so that when you do have your operations set up, you're able to communicate, you're able to kind of carry out the operations that you want to? So I think those are the two key aspects really that we're seeing a lot of focus at the moment. So one slightly more yeah. short-term tactical, one more in terms of informing what is actually the setup going to be, what does the infrastructure look like.
And it's interesting because I think to bring both of your points together in terms of the opportunity that's in front, but the challenge of resilience, we've certainly seen a lot of Western, and particularly companies like Microsoft, spend a lot of time early on during the conflict, but certainly since then in sort of providing the infrastructure. We had the Elon Musk kind of interesting moment with satellite telecommunications, but we've definitely seen that interest from a global perspective of this is going to be a new world post the situation on the ground evolving, and certainly will probably set the foundation for a lot of what we are to expect from a public-private partnership perspective, but from FDI coming into a country that will need a fundamental rebuild of its very infrastructure. We could talk about this for days and days, and I do want to sort of give a shout out to the webinar that you recently were both part of, I believe, or certainly were control risks, geopolitical risk experts and security risk experts who have spent a lot of time both on the ground in Kiev, but looking at the situation for listeners if they wanted to go and dive a little bit more into the topic. But I want to take us into the future a little bit, because Botta, you said, you know, we don't foresee an end to the war in the immediate future. You know, the tactical gains and losses on both sides have been really the narrative over the past year and a half. We have major dates this year. We have an election in Russia. We have a European Parliament election. We have a US election. All of these will have an impact on the situation on the ground. So if you project yourself over the next few years, where do you think the situation is likely to move towards? Nobody's going to hold you to it. This is no, there's no crystal ball. But importantly, what are some of the big things that people should keep in the front of their minds when they're thinking about where the situation is going? Yeah.
You know what? This is a great question, but also a tough one to answer, yeah. even to the lead geopolitical analyst on Ukraine and Russia,
yeah.
simply because there are just so many different moving parts.
Yeah.
And also because 2024 is going to be such a decisive year, precisely for those reasons that you just mentioned, right? US election, Russian election. I think we all know mm-hmm. what's going to happen in that one. And so many things also happening on the front lines, Europe deciding which weapons and missiles to send and fighter jets and all of that. But I think if we are to go back to the fundamentals, to me, there are, I would say, the key drivers that are going to decide the outcome of this particular war, and therefore where we are likely to see the war in a few years' time are the following, right? So first of all, I think that the end of the war is likely if we are to see a U-turn when it comes to the political leadership in either Russia or Ukraine, right? Because at the present moment, with the two governments in place, we are very much unlikely to see genuine negotiations in place, right? So Ukraine believes that any efforts to put a ceasefire in place are going to be counterproductive because it argues that Russia would just simply use this break to regroup, rearm, and attack in Ukraine, and attack Ukraine again, right? Because Ukraine says that the 2022 full-scale invasion was essentially the continuation of the 2014 invasion, right? Took that break, they returned in greater numbers with more weapons and so on, right? And there's some truth to that, I believe. Yeah. And then on the other side, you have President Putin, who believes that what he's doing in Ukraine has become such a big part of his domestic legitimacy, and he is going to be reelected in the 2024 election. He's going to win another six-year term. So unless we see a complete overhaul of other political leadership, we are unlikely to see the genuine efforts from Ukraine and Russia to engage in peace talks. And we consider such changes to be unlikely.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ukraine will remain pro-EU and pro-NATO. This is very unlikely to change. There are no pro-Russian voices left, essentially, in the political landscape in Ukraine, understandably so, right? So this is very unlikely to change. So Ukraine will very much remain firmly in you know, the mindset of joining the EU, joining NATO. How long it takes the country to do that as a whole, as a subject for a separate conversation, many conversations, in fact, right? But that course has been set, it has been entrenched, and this is very likely to change. When it comes to Russia as well, right? So I do think that the way things are going now, we are unlikely to see a change in the political leadership that is going to generate, you know, Russia being able to say, you know what, let us withdraw our forces. Yeah. We are getting out of Ukraine. We were wrong. Let us pay the war reparations and so on. So that's very unlikely to happen as well. Another wild card here is the outcome of US elections. As I mentioned, so the US is the single largest military and economic backer of the country.
Yeah.
And should there be a big change in who takes office in January 2025, that is going to be the greatest single threat to Ukraine, right? So Trump, who is essentially pretty much the Republican nominee at this point, has made it very clear, crystal clear, actually, that he is not going to keep arming Ukraine. Mm-hmm. In fact, I mean, he's even said things like, you know what, we will only help the NATO countries that meet their defense.
Yep, the 2%.
The 2% threshold. Yep. Exactly, thanks. So I think it's fair to say that in the event, and it's a credible scenario, right, that Trump makes his comeback despite, again, against all of the odds, and he's back in early 2025. Mm-hmm. He says, you know what, we're not supporting Ukraine anymore. Ukraine is going to be in a tough spot.
Yeah.
And that's because Europe, no matter how much they want to see Ukraine, quote unquote, win this war, right? They are just unable to replace all that American and US weaponry.
Yeah.
Right. So Ukraine, I think the pressure on Ukraine to start thinking about making some concessions is going to increase in that event. However, I will caveat this by saying that Ukraine can strengthen its negotiating position if it is able to make certain tactical gains in 2024. Yeah. But again, that's going to be tough because the flow of Western arms and US arms that has been flowing into Ukraine in 2024 has already been reduced. So that's going to be, let's just say that there's a lot of uncertainty.
Right.
Right. And there's a fairly good chance that in a few years' time, the war is going to be on in some form, whether it's a frozen conflict in the east and southern, like in southern parts of Ukraine or something bigger.
Which I think, and Stina, I want your take on this, because I think when we look at from a cyber perspective, I mean, the post-Crimean invasion in 2014 and the imposition of sanctions on Russia led to malware variants like Black Energy, led to large-scale disruption of European energy infrastructure, and was really the beginning of this kind of highly disruptive cyber patterns that was displayed by actors emanating out of Russia. If we go from the premise that Bolta is laying out in front of us here, which is really this has been a continuation of a foreign policy objective by Russia, And we don't foresee any significant change, bar these external conditions that were being laid out just now, in the military and tactical landscape. You know, what does that mean from a cyber perspective? We talked, and sorry, this is going to be a really long question, so just bear with me. We talked about, you know, we all thought when the invasion began, we would see that big boom of large-scale disruptive attack takes down the entirety of the country's infrastructure. We talked about this a year ago. We said it didn't happen for a number of reasons, not least infrastructure defenses were in place in Ukraine, but also Russia needed the infrastructure to be running. If you think about the scenario that Bolt is laying out in front of us here, where we may actually be entering a very long-term frozen conflict, what does that mean from a cyber perspective? Are we expecting the spillover to continue into other parts of either Ukraine or certainly Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and the US from a cyber perspective? Or do we think the efforts are going to remain concentrated on what we've seen right now, which is very infrastructure driven within Ukraine?
That's a big question.
Just an easy thing to start in the morning.
I can start unpacking that. So, I mean, I think first of all, it's important, and you're absolutely right to point out that we all feared that big boom, and particularly that kind of widespread knock-on effects outside. We haven't seen this. So, I mean, what we have seen is systematic targeting of organizations outside of Ukraine, particularly in countries that are kind of within NATO, within EU, that have pledged support, so on, right? That's been part of this at a level where, again, we come to the point that is always challenging for us, Nick, mm-hmm. in terms of attribution, right? In terms of linking that type of activity to a particular state actor that can be held accountable under, you know, international mm-hmm. legal frameworks, right? This is where we are, right? So it's quite, I don't want to use the word clever, but right, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing an uptick in ransomware. We're seeing an uptick in disruptive targeting through DDoS, through defacement, and so on against organizations outside. So that's a key part of this, and a key element will continue to be that. I think it's focusing on retaliation within the space of the gray zone within cyber, which is a big zone, right? Where we
it's
are
a big
there.
Gray zone, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big gray zone. So I think that's one part of it. And, you know, based on what Botta is outlining here and the number of kind of uncertainties, but actually clarity in terms of where we think realistically we're going in this, that's going to be kind of constant feature. That's something that as security teams, this is just the
that's
new
right.
normal. Right? This is just something that we needs to be factored in. I think from a kind of forward-looking perspective for organizations that are looking to enter, that are getting involved in this in some capacity. Again, security teams need to think of this as the long game, right? You will be on the radar. There will be spikes in that. It will be up and down. And depending on the level of presence in Ukraine, depending on where you sit in the order of priority, I think that's the key thing to consider going forward is understanding where does your organization fit within that wider objective of Russia within this conflict. But getting ready for this being, you know, this is going to be what you're faced against kind of in the long term.
Look, I I'm very conscious that we could go on talking about this for hours on end. So if I can just summarize what we're bringing together, the two points that you guys just laid out here is, we don't expect a magical resolution of the situation on the ground. We expect to see a continuation of the minor tactical gains. There are big questions this year, huge questions. And I think that go beyond the situation in Ukraine. I think, you know, we talked on a recent podcast around AI regulations. We've got one coming on disruptive cyber attacks. All of this is tied to the geopolitical landscape, and particularly elections in the US this coming year. But when we think about it from a cyber perspective, this is really just the beginning of what is a new normal in terms of capability development, in terms of, you know, we've talked about the challenge of attribution. We've talked about the leveraging of proxy criminal groups to target organizations that are involved in one way or another at a distance or from up close with foreign policy objectives of various nation states. The reality is we need to be ready over the coming years to deal with this constant state of security, whether in a physical or in a cyber realm, risks for organizations that are involved in operations in Ukraine or in Russia. Well, thank you both so much for being here this morning. It's always fascinating to have you on. And Balta, thank you so much for being here this morning. You're the lead author of the Rebuild Ukraine Special Report, where we provide unique investment insights for companies that are going back into Ukraine or are thinking about going back into Ukraine. It's a pleasure to have you on, and hopefully we'll see you very soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Stina, as always, thank you so much for being here. It's a real treat to have you on, and I look forward to having you back on Decrypt very soon.
Thanks very much, Nick, and thanks for a good discussion.
We have a whole host of episodes coming soon to Decrypt, covering the most crucial topics, breaking news, and strategic horizon scanning within the world of cyber that you need to be aware of. With analysis and discussion from our experts located around the world, subscribe to Control Risks Decrypt as we help you make sense of the cyber and technology issues impacting your business. For more information on how we can help you build a resilient, compliant, and secure organization, realizing the benefits of technology, visit us at www.controlrisks.com. And remember, our experts are only ever one email away. Email us at cyber@controlrisks.com.